listening to Enemy Combatant Radio, and I'm Sasha, and with us is Ralph today in the studio. Ralph is a researcher and media activist who does basically privacy policy studies from Germany. And why don't you tell us... Sorry?
Hi, Sasha.
Hi. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the conference that you were in town for?
Yeah, this conference is called Computers, Freedom and Privacy. It's run by the Association for Computing Machinery. I think it was the 14th this year. And it used to be the annual big, important, leading-edge conference for all the privacy, crypto, cypherpunk, whatever, activists, researchers, and policymakers, basically from North America, but also with involvement from Europe and other places. This year's conference was a bit lame. I don't really know why. But
I know why.
Tell me.
Well, who was it sponsored by?
Well, by some corporations. Guess which ones? Microsoft was among them, Yahoo, some others. I don't have the complete list in my mind. I remember the first time I was at this conference was in Boston 3 years ago, and they had, in the coffee breaks, they had cookies you could eat to your coffee, and they had nice signs saying, cookies provided by DoubleClick. But I think that's not the reason why the conference was lame. I think it's more... it's been running for quite a while, for 14 years now, and maybe people are getting, or people who go to this conference and run this conference have gotten a bit tired, or I don't know. I mean, the conference venue was, for example, interesting. It was this fancy upscale hotel in Berkeley, the Claremont Resort and Spa, with at least 10 tennis courts and 2 swimming pools and so on. Conference fee was, I think, $750 for normal attendees. Yeah, there were some special rates for students, and press could get in for free, but not even the press was very present there. There was one reporter from Germany, one guy from Wired News, but that's it. Not even famous Declan McCulloch from Washington, who used to go to this conference every year, was there.
I don't know that much about the background, but Art McGee, who does tech support stuff with Black Radical Congress and other groups, was telling me a little bit last week about... some of the history, and I may get this wrong, but I think he indicated to me that it used to be organized by Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility and some other groups that had somewhat more of a grassroots, and in some cases more radical constituency. And as you were saying, it was cypherpunks and people who were interesting coders and people doing interesting crypto and privacy stuff. And he described to me a process where at a certain point several years ago they just kind of backed off the scene, and that's when ACM took it over and they invited all the corporate sponsorship. And he said that since then, surprise surprise, it's gone down the path you've described. It's become very sort of corporatized, expensive, and less of a sort of interesting place. Yeah. But
this year it was not that bad in terms of cypherpunks, because it was here in the Bay Area. A lot of people from Silicon Valley, real coders and computer geeks, were actually there. But on the other hand, many real important people from the East Coast and from Europe were missing, who normally went there every year, like Mark Rotenberg, the big boss of Electronic Privacy Information Center in Washington, wasn't there. Simon Davis, who founded the Big Brother Award, wasn't there. They used to come every year, mm-hmm. and now they didn't come anymore. I don't know why.
Now, who else came this year who didn't used to come in the past? There were some government people there, weren't there?
Yeah, for the first time they had a lady giving a keynote speech on the last day over lunch from the Department of Justice, I think, from the terrorism unit. And what was really interesting, there was a big session yesterday morning, plenary session, on government data mining, profiling, and so on, with some privacy activists and this lady from, what's the company called again, Axiom or something?
I'm not sure.
Who sells tons of private personal information it gets from marketers and from all kinds of sources to the government, to Homeland Security now for the passenger profiling and stuff like that. So they basically provide the data that when you want to board an airplane makes these either green, orange, or red light turn on. And red means you can't board the airplane and interrogated by the police. Yellow means you might be able, but you have to answer some questions. And green means you're fine.
Did you have any problems on your plane flight into the US?
I didn't, no. But there are a number of people actually who from Europe, for example, who say they won't go to the US anymore after September this year, when everybody except, I think, people from Canada and Mexico are have to give their fingerprints and are being photographed at the airport. And many people don't want to do that.
What were you saying earlier today about retinal scans at the airport?
Oh yeah, there was a there's a pilot project going on at the moment, and some people who just stayed at the hotel, I just chatted with them on the patio where I had a cigarette, tourists from Germany basically, they flew through Frankfurt Airport, and there was this possibility to voluntarily get your retina scanned. And they just did it because they thought, oh yeah, it might help us to get through US customs faster, you know, to avoid the long queues. It actually didn't help them, but it showed me in a way how little awareness there is of privacy among the normal population, because they just gave away their most intimate eye data just to avoid a queue for like 15 or 30 minutes.
Do you think that in terms of the difference between, I don't know, the EU or at least Germany and the US, what's your sense in terms of the level of both public awareness and then maybe activism that's happening at the policy level or at the from the bottom up at the movement level, in terms of where do you think that people are getting more organized around privacy and surveillance and data mining and so on? And do you see a difference between the European context and here?
Yeah, I think the general policy difference, and that might explain a lot, is that in Europe we have quite comprehensive data protection or privacy laws that cover not only government handling of your personal data, but also corporate use of data. While in the US, the Privacy Act of 74 and some other acts mainly cover how the government can handle your personal data, and the private sector basically can do what they want. You can opt out of their databases, but not of all of them, because some of them are used for homeland security, as I said earlier. So here, the situation, the privacy legislation situation is worse than in Europe, definitely, and that makes a lot of people more active and more organized and more outspoken. Whereas in Europe, you have this nice legal framework, you have mandatory data protection commissioners on the federal level and the state level and at company level and so on. So they more or less behave within this framework and don't tend to be that radical anymore.
You have mandatory data protection commissioners for both for corporations and in the government.
Yes.
And is there anything analogous in the US?
Well, that was interesting. I don't think it's mandatory for corporations here. As I said, there's basically no regulation how corporations can handle your personal data. But on the government level, there was a conference call on one of the days at the conference with the chief privacy officer of the Department for Homeland Security. And from what she told us, it's the first time that a federal government agency or branch has a chief privacy officer.
So what is her role as chief privacy officer of Homeland Security?
Well, she tried to tell us that she makes sure that the data is not misused, that it's correct, and that you can, if you, for example, want to board an airplane and the red light pops up, you can find out why that's the case, and if it's just incorrect data, you can correct it, and so on.
And you can do that from Guantanamo with an orange bag over your head?
Of course not.
So did anyone give her any hard questions?
Yeah, of course. And the general feeling and my impression of what's her real job is she's basically the nice woman talking to the press and to the critical privacy activists, but in the end trying to sell the general idea of homeland security, data mining, profiling, and so on, because it's all for security, so it's good. We just have to make sure the data is correct, you know.
Now, the U.S. must be putting serious pressure on various, you know, EU governments to conform with their surveillance regime. How is that sort of playing out? either.
Yeah, for example, the European Union now is working on a new generation of passports, which has, I think, chips on it or some kind of special encrypted barcode or something, where your biometric information. I think they still haven't agreed on which kind of, if it's a face scan, a retina scan, scan or fingerprint or something. But your biometric information is stored in the passport, which is interesting because the US, as far as I've heard, are not planning to do that with their own passport so far.
But well, I think
on another level, if I may add that, that was very interesting. There was another lady from the Department of Justice Cybercrime Unit on one of the panels, and in Europe there's a big fight at the moment about mandatory data retention, you know, that the ISPs, the internet providers, have to store all your data, or at least all your traffic data, for half a year, no matter if you're a suspect or not, just for anybody. A huge fight at the moment also in Germany, where the federal government, which is a bit more left liberal, red-green government at the moment, doesn't want to do that, and the parliament doesn't want to do that. But the Council of Federal States, which has to agree to this law, definitely wants it because it's a conservative majority there. And they all use kind of the excuse of, yeah, well, it's in the framework of the global war on terrorism and all the other countries are also doing it. We have obligations for international cooperation and so on. But here at the conference,
everybody's doing it.
Yeah. But here at the conference, this lady from the DOJ cybercrime unit basically told us, oh no, the US government is not interested in mandatory data retention. No way. We don't want to do that. We just want to make sure that if we have special suspects, you know, we can name individually. We want to make sure that we can preserve some data that's connected to the special case. But we don't want mandatory data retention for all data.
Well, that's because they have plans to retain as much data as possible themselves on their own servers, so they don't need to go into ISPs. So do they talk about total information awareness at all? We're now renamed terrorist information awareness?
Yeah, but that's not... as far as I know, the total information awareness system is not... they are not planning to store all my internet traffic. They are just trying to gather data from direct marketers and other sources and do data mining with that. Mm.
So this question of sort of the difference between maybe the U.S. policies and European policies, regardless of which faction is sort of more fascist in their application of, you know, data surveillance and repression, it raises the question of sort of international standards, international policy, and, you know, how those policies are being made and set right now is another sort of interesting topic that you've been spending a lot of time on as well. Maybe you could talk a little bit about...
Yeah, I mean, if you start with data protection, there are all kinds of international agreements, guidelines in the OECD, even the UN has a resolution on data protection. The EU directive on data protection from 95 also affects third parties, third countries, if my data from Europe is supposed to be sent to the US, for example, but also in other areas like cybercrime. The Cybercrime Convention, which was being developed in the Council of Europe, for all you Americans, this is not the same as the European Union, it's a different, broader organization. And the Cybercrime Convention was developed with the, well, help, quote-unquote, of US DOJ, for example, and FBI involvement.
What are some of the worst components of the Cybercrime Convention?
One of the worst components is that there's no regulation on dual criminality. Is that the correct term in English?
So you can be prosecuted in more than one country for the same crime?
No, you can. You can. If for example, in Germany, some kind of hate speech like Nazi propaganda is a crime, whereas in the US it is not. But if the German police is after somebody for Nazi propaganda on the internet, this is considered a cybercrime in Germany, they can just put his name in this big database, and the US police, I think they don't even find out why the German police is behind him. They have to, if they catch him, they have to give him to the German police, even if it's not a crime in the US. This is one of the worst regulations, and it's very broad. It basically covers all kinds of crime. The only condition is that the criminals have to have used the internet during the course of the crime. So basically, if you stab somebody in the back and rob their wallet, and at the same time call your friend to get a car at the next corner and pick you up, and your cell phone has some kind of internet connectivity that could be considered a cybercrime. So it's very, very broad.
And so does that convention have any implications for encryption laws? Are they trying to harmonize those? Because I know that the US...
As far as I'm informed, it's not about encryption. There was some discussion on hacking technology, hacking software. You know, it could make the possession of hacking software illegal, where many, many system administrators said, hey, we need this stuff to find out the holes in our own systems, you know, for like white hat hacking.
Well, that's interesting, because you just gave an example of someone who stabs their friend in the back, but it could also be a case where one country that's party to the convention criminalizes a particular piece of software, say, and then prosecutes people in another country, and they are forced to...
Could be. So it's terribly broad, and there are no regulations on privacy and data protection in it. It's open now. It just actually went into force, I think, 2 weeks ago, after five countries have ratified it. And now it's open to all other countries, not only Council of Europe members. So even, not very democratic countries, for example, I don't know, China, Syria, what you have, could
these
join.
These are countries that have large numbers of so-called cyber dissidents imprisoning people just for basically speech, for publishing stuff on websites and whatnot.
Yeah, or just for accessing it.
Right.
I mean, that's another thing we wanted to talk about, this World Summit on the Information Society I've been involved with. The next phase is just about to start. It will take place in Tunisia. And the first preparatory conference where all the world's governments meet to prepare for the summit and negotiate on the official documents and so on is taking place at the end of June in Tunisia. And this will really affect our work there, because in Tunisia, people end up in jail for just accessing websites of human rights organizations. Crypto is illegal in Tunisia, and so on. So it's going to be pretty interesting, to say the least.
So are there any groups that are sort of mobilizing to say, hey, this is taking place in Tunisia, which has terribly undemocratic laws as far as, you know, internet access, and it's supposed to be a conference about extending the benefits of net access and communication to all people?
Yeah, a number of groups are very active in that regard, and they've already started last year. The human rights groups involved in the summit process have been very outspoken on it. We are at the moment trying to get the more traditional human rights organizations like Amnesty and so on board, because they haven't been terribly interested in information society issues so far. So this is our attempt to get them interested in that also, and of course help us with the Tunisian situation. But also the European Union on an official level has issued some kind of official statement on Tunisia. And I think even President Bush has told the Tunisian President Ben Ali recently that the human rights situation in Tunisia could be better.
Well, that's pretty funny.
But I mean, that's for the press. I don't know what they do in behind closed doors, you know. I wouldn't trust President Bush very much here.
I don't think we want to know what they do behind closed doors.
I would like to know.
So the governments are, you know, laying out their positions and so on, and, you know, Bush is opportunistically using it as a chance to point out human rights violations and imprisonment of dissidents in other countries. Meanwhile, they're disappearing and imprisoning thousands of people in the U.S. for violations, not even for violations in the so-called war on terror. So meanwhile, you know, what do you think that sort of groups, are groups mobilizing not just governments and human rights NGOs and so on, but what about social movements and independent media activists and so on? What's their role in these discussions about global regimes of information and privacy? What is it, or what could it be? What do we need to do?
You mean in the context of the World Summit or in general?
Well, just in general. I mean, or do you see the World Summit as a place where people should be getting involved, or are there other places that people should be focusing their energy? Or,
well, I think both. That was my experience, having been involved in the first phase of the summit. You know, it's a very unusual summit. It's taking place in two parts. First part was last December in Geneva. Second part will be 2005 in Tunisia. in the first phase, which lasted about 2 years with all these preparatory conferences and so on, it was a great chance for all kinds of different groups to really meet on a global level for the first time and engage with each other and discuss and identify common friends and foes and so on. So all these people who have been working in their field and have pretty good international connections, more or less normally, like privacy watchdogs, community media activists, classical journalist associations, library associations, the whole free software movement and so on, they, for the first time on a global level, got together in this summit process and developed a common position. In the end, we came up with our own alternative civil society kind of activist social movement summit declaration, which was much better than the official one, of course. I have to say that. So this was really a great chance for networking and global strategizing and getting a nice overview over the different groups and how they could work more together in the future. The second phase, I think, will be more difficult because in Geneva they already agreed on this official summit declaration, which is not as bad as we had feared in the beginning, but it's just basically a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And now the next phase will also be about how to implement this, like how to bring this piece of paper, this global policy concept in a way, down to the real world. And there, of course, we have to engage more in different areas, like the real deals and real decisions on intellectual property policy, for example, are not made at the summit, but are made in WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization. So we have to reach out to these areas now. But the summit process, I think, will still be a nice forum to get all of it together.
There's been actually some increasing activism around the WIPO, the Intellectual Property Organization. So I know that last summer there was an action organized by No Borders Network where they had several thousand people who marched from the World Trade Organization to the International Organization of Migration to the World Intellectual Property Organization. And the demand was basically saying, well, the WTO is about freeing up borders for capital to flow freely. But we think that people should be able to flow freely across borders, and that's why they went to the International Organization of Migration. And then they said they went to WIPO next because they said WIPO is about controlling knowledge and the flow of information and ideas, enforcing basically the U.S. model of copyright and patents across the world, mm-hmm. and encouraging
intellectual property.
Yeah,
basically of the idea that ideas are a commodity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is some resistance to WIPO, and during mm-hmm. during the first phase of the WSIS process, there was an action organized by the WECs group and the Geneva 03 Collective, where the Negative Lands film "Gimme the Mermaid" was projected on the wall of WIPO, and this is mm-hmm. a film that's all made by, it's basically cut up pieces of Disney films over the voice of a record executive saying things like, "It's all mine, every bit of it. You can't even have a moment of it. It's all mine." And it's just real actual phone calls, you know, recorded with these guys in disputes over intellectual property. And then I actually just saw today in my inbox that ACT UP Paris is going to be doing an action against the Intellectual Property Organization with the demand that basically generic drugs for treating AIDS be released. WIPO has played a big role in trying to crack down on countries that want to release generic AIDS drugs to treat their people, while basically mostly U.S. big pharmaceutical companies want to sell their brand name versions for, you know, 20 to 50 times the cost. So there's an interesting possibility, I think, for different sectors to unite against this yeah. particular version of intellectual property.
Yeah. One more example, just 2 weeks ago there was a demonstration in Brussels in front of the European Parliament where a big fight is at the moment going on between the Parliament and the European Commission over the question of software patents. Should there be something like patents on software, on algorithms, which is basically ideas in a way, like mathematical formulas. The Parliament was against it, very outspoken. The Commission is in favor of it under pressure of a number of big corporations. And now, yeah, somebody has to decide, or they have to get together and to decide in a way. And there was a demonstration of 800 people in front of the European Parliament on software patents. I mean, this is, we're talking about geeks here who normally just leave their computer to go to the bathroom or something like that. And they all went to Brussels and demonstrated. And that the first demonstration they had about that in Brussels, I think last September, that was 50 people. Now it was 800. And they all were wearing T-shirts saying, no software patents, power to the parliament, which I liked very much.
Why, so I think there's some momentum building. Why was it power to the parliament? There. Can you explain that?
Because the parliament is against software patents. So it's in favor of free software, and the whole idea of software shouldn't be subject to intellectual property regimes. And yeah, but the Commission, the European Commission, which is kind of the European government in a way, well, in a way, the Commission wants to introduce patents on software.
Maybe we should try and talk about organizing some global days of action against against software patents and patents on ideas and so on. It sounds like there's a lot of mobilization happening in different parts of the world around that. Well, is there any other comments that you want to make? What's the next? How can people get involved with the WSIS process if they want? And what's next?
You can, of course, visit my website. I have a contract with the Böll Foundation in Germany, where I'm running a website on the whole World Summit developments. It's called www.worldsummit2005.org. Where you find the latest updates. And one of the upcoming meetings, which you all are invited to come to, is in Berlin in June, 13th of June, where we have the European North American Civil Society NGO activist meeting on the World Summit and the general strategy for the next phase and how to link the summit discussions to all the other shit that's going on everywhere. The meeting is one day, but before that, there's a whole big conference called the Wizards of Oz, like OS, like open source, where a number of really cool people are coming, and we're launching the German version of the Creative Commons license, for example. A number of other groups are meeting that week in Berlin, and it's going to be real fun, and a lot of stuff happening there.
When is that, and how can people find out more about it?
The Wizards of Oz is from the 10th to 12th June, and our World Summit meeting is on the 13th. The conference website is www.wizards-of-os.org. Yeah, and I tell you, Berlin in summer is just great. You're going to love it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.